is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
And as we come to you this lunchtime, a nasty pest in horticulture is continuing to spread in Victoria. We'll give you the details we have shortly. I've also got a new mango variety for you. That's in our rural news today. You're going to have to listen out for that. But it's this. This thing has grabbed my ear today and it's had my mind working ever since I heard it. We'll talk today about the difficulties facing people in the wine industry. Some saying it's at one of their lowest points on record, with businesses finding the economic challenges so tough that many are being forced to exit the industry. It's the reasons behind it that has me thinking today. And it's this point that has come from one member of the wine industry from Western Australia that has me thinking, and I want to know what you think about that. This is his thoughts about the core of the problems facing those who are producing wine.
One of the biggest ones being the growth in the use of all things cannabis. The line of alcohol consumption and the line of cannabis consumption crossed paths last year, where cannabis is now higher daily use than alcohol. So it's not so much the headline you see is, oh, you know, the younger generation, wellness, etc. I dispute that. I think it's more of a case of drugs taking the place of alcohol for a lot of people, and that's shown up in the consumption.
What do you make of that? What do you think about that? If you're involved in the wine industry, if you're involved in craft beer, even if you're just a consumer of these products, do you think that Australians, particularly younger Australians being referenced there, have changed their drug of choice? So things like alcohol are on the way out, which obviously has a lot of farming roots to it, a lot of businesses around regional areas like Victoria attached to it. Has that been phased out because there's a different drug of choice in town?
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
While you think about that, and I reckon you'll be thinking about that like I have been for the last couple of hours, whether you work out whether that's true or not, I want you to let me know. Let's talk about a nasty pest that looks like it's spreading in Victoria. A pest first found in Victoria last year has been discovered again, but in a new region, prompting new biosecurity restrictions. Tomato potato psyllid was found on the Bellarine Peninsula in 2024, so last year, pretty much this day last year. And that area has been operating under a protected area ever since. But now, Agriculture Victoria tells us tomato potato psyllid's been found in a garden in Melbourne's northern suburbs, prompting more restrictions and more briefings to happen for particularly the horticulture industry, particularly the nursery industry as well. And we're trying to find out more details on that at the moment. We've got a request in for Victoria's Chief Plant Health Officer. What I can tell you is TPP, tomato potato psyllid, is a small insect that feeds on hosts such as potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, chili and capsicum. It was detected in Victoria for the first time on the 12th of November 2024 on the Bellarine Peninsula. A restricted area has been in place since that detection to contain the pest from spreading further into other areas of Victoria. But now it's been found in Melbourne's northern suburbs as well. Now, this psyllid is established around Perth in Western Australia, can't be eradicated there. And it's considered a real serious plant disease, particularly for potatoes, because it can be known to cause zebra chip in potatoes, which is a really big problem for that industry and a big problem for our export markets as well. So a lot of people will be keeping an eye on what's happening with tomato potato psyllid. If you've got anything to report, you can call the Exotic Plant Pest Hotline on 1-800-084-881. 1-800-084-881. When we hear more, we'll bring you more here on the Country Hour. Let's keep talking potatoes though, right? Because a split is developing between the mainland and Tasmanian potato industries over what to do about potato mop-top virus. It was discovered and declared endemic in Victoria this year. In Tasmania this year. Mop-top virus has led to the closing of the borders then for potatoes between the mainland and Tasmania, as it puts a key risk to our export markets, which Victoria sends a lot to. In fact, the mainland in general. Before the discovery of the virus, seed potatoes from Tasmania did make it into Victorian sheds. They haven't been planted, and now they sit in limbo, and a lot of people are worried about what to do with it. And that's where the split between mainland and Tasmanian industries starts to arise. Here's Nigel Crump speaking to us on the Country Hour about the really the Victorian perspective on all of this.
So there's about 632 tonnes that came across to the mainland, mostly into South Australia and Victoria. And in a couple of those consignments, we've actually detected the virus there. And as you said, luckily, none of that seed had been planted. So we've managed to prevent that seed from being established into the mainland. And so far, we've stopped the virus in its tracks.
So what happens to that seed, though, that the contaminated seed?
The contaminated seed at the moment, I believe, is under a quarantine, issued under quarantine by the Victorian government. So we're looking at how that seed's going to be either processed out or destroyed. But we're just equally concerned about the material that is here that has been tested and negative, because one thing the test does, we're using a PCR test, same as what we did with COVID, but it tests the flesh of the tuber. It doesn't test the virus is actually spread through a soil-borne fungus called Spongospora, which could be on the outside of the tuber. So if that fungus is there, it can drop off, go into the soil, and then contaminate the soil into the future. So we're equally concerned about, given that the endemic nature, as you said in the intro there, about the disease in Tasmania, we're equally concerned about any of the seed and soil sources coming out of Tasmania.
So is it your hope that all of that seed then gets destroyed or sent back to Tasmania?
We've really been pushing for that. We've actually written a letter to the Biosecurity Tasmania asking whether they could actually return the seed. And that'll be interesting because Tasmania has a interesting biosecurity where they don't have any movement of potatoes going from the mainland.
So you're not allowed to send it back?
We're not allowed to send it back. Generally, typically in the past, we haven't been able to send it back, and we're not allowed to send anything down there. And that's their biosecurity, and that's for potato cyst nematode and a few other things. So we're in the process of asking that. We're also lobbying governments here, Victorian and South Australian governments, to see what we can do about that seed that's here, to see if we can avoid having this problem. Because we've got a large export market that's going into Indonesia and Thailand, and those countries don't want mop top either. And we've tested all that seed that's gone across there this year, over 1,500 tonnes, and we still haven't been able to find the virus. So we want to keep it that way.
So that's Nigel Crump from AusPicker, the Independent Seed Potato Certification Authority, speaking there with a mainland position on this, saying we want to protect export markets here and protect the industry here, and we need more information. We've got requests in with Agriculture Victoria on what's happening there. When we hear more, we'll let you know. Let's travel over to Tasmania now, where their seed potato industry is calling for wider testing for potato mop top virus on the mainland. Doug Clark from the state's potato seed certification scheme says authorities on the mainland are pushing to return all Tasmanian seed potatoes back to their state, but he says their biosecurity requirements may not allow that, as the state has already tracked and traced where the virus has been. He says it's now up to the mainland producers to do more stringent testing to try and detect if the virus is still present there.
When we do a core test on a potato, that result either comes back as positive or not detected. It's never a negative test. So whilst that outcome, it could have very low levels of mop top present within that line, or it may not have any of that virus present. So they're the two outcomes. It's never a negative test as such. So what we do know is that the lines that were moved to the mainland prior to the known outbreak of mop top in Tasmania, ready for the mainlanders to grow, is I believe that we've had two positive detections in two of those lines, like on those lines, but the other lines over there have had multiple tests conducted on them, and my understanding is that those tests have come back as not detected.
But it sounds like the Australian Seed Potato Industry Certification Authority isn't 100% confident in the testing. Are you suggesting that mainland farmers should just risk it and plant the Tassie seed anyway?
Look, it always comes back to either personal choice or requirements of biosecurity in each jurisdiction. So I don't want to talk around the biosecurity in each jurisdiction, and that's up to them. I'm not going to go there. But what we do know, and through our testing in Tasmania, we have been able to give our Tasmanian growers great confidence around the presence of mop top in our seed potato lines. So that's a really good outcome. In way, are you better off to test and know what the status is versus not getting seed tested at all and taking the risk on planting that seed? So, yeah, so yesterday AusPicker touched on the actual testing itself and the core testing component. So we followed the AusPicker export requirements for that, and Nigel is totally correct, is that the virus could be on the external of the potato. But ultimately, we've tested to the best of our abilities, in the time frame we had. So that's all we can do and give Tasmanian growers in the first instance great surety around the presence of Moptop in those lines, which at the moment, mainland states do not have the ability or have not tested lines to, on a broader scale, to determine the status of Moptop within those lines.
So can seed potatoes that have come from Tasmania sent to Victoria be sent back here?
That's ultimately up to Biosecurity TAS to make that call. I would strongly suggest that those potatoes that have been delivered to the mainland would not meet import requirements back into Tasmania, the re-entry requirements. So ultimately that's up to Biosecurity TAS, and that's where I'd probably like to stop that comment.
it's clearly a sore point. So what does it mean for Tasmania if the industry can't export its potatoes to the mainland? Because it's clear that there's a little standoff going on here, that there is a meeting coming up on the 18th, but it sounds like a lot of the states are getting together and saying, we shouldn't accept these spuds from Tassie.
Look, there has been an open pathway from Tasmania to the mainland for decades for both movement of seed but also wet potatoes. So what, for me, one of the main outcomes I'd really like from next week is a really good understanding around the presence of Moptop on the mainland. So we know that accurately about Tasmania now because we undertook a really wide-reaching testing program. So at the moment, we as an industry, a whole Australian national potato industry, are really unsure if the distribution or possible distribution of Moptop on the mainland. So until we get a good picture on what that actually looks like, how can we then facilitate trade either between states or give growers the surety around what the presence of Moptop is within those lines? Because ultimately, we've got a bit of a hole in biosecurity somewhere. It's come into the country through a pathway, and at the moment, certainly Tasmanian growers, potato and Biosecurity TAS, cannot identify that pathway. So that is a huge concern to the Australian industry, because what else, wherever that entry point is, we need to the best of our ability identify where that is at and close it as soon as we can.
And that's obviously done through wider testing. We've obviously exhausted that in Tassie, but not necessarily on the mainland.
Yeah, correct. So it comes back to that tracking and tracing. So one of the things we do know in Tasmania, we had multiple sites that the only plant material they bring in is early generation potatoes. That's a concern, is that we've got highly isolated sites. They do on their own planting, own cultivation on site. They don't bring any third-party machinery on. So that's the bit that concerns us at the moment. So, this is going to be one of the good things about the meeting next week, is hopefully for the small amount of testing that some private companies may have been doing, and maybe AusPicker themselves, I'm really hoping they're able to bring that data to the meeting and say, hey, look, this is the bit that we know, and that we possibly identify areas on a broader scale where, we could possibly do some testing on a national scale to actually build a area absence or presence of, so then seed can be grown within those areas with a high degree of surety that, they're going to be free from Moptop.
That is Doug Clark there from TasSeed, Tasmania's Potato Seed Certification Scheme, speaking with Larissa Smith in Tasmania. There are a few of your texts coming in. Chris says they need high heat to destroy those seed potatoes. That's Chris's view there. Brian says, don't blame cockies for biosecurity problems. I blame wholly and solely at the feet of biosecurity departments. And we're working hard defence, which of course is rubbish. Consecutive governments for thinking cutting funding in these departments is necessary, which of course is the most irresponsible action taken by any government, state, fed or local, who are clearly ignorant of the country's biosecurity's need, says Brian. Up next here on the Country Hour, we're talking about, maybe your drug of choice. Maybe it has changed. Maybe that's affecting the produce of a region near you. Someone in the wine industry thinks cannabis substitution is costing the wine industry a lot of production. I've been asking you, what do you make of that? Plugger wants me to play a Kevin Bloody Wilson song. Plugger, I doubt there's many in that catalogue that are ABC radio friendly. And another text says, it's pretty simple to work out. The average person can't afford to drink anymore. The prices have forced them to drugs. Look at cigarettes. It's the same thing. It started something illegal. In 1999, a carton of beer was $23.95. It took 100 years to get where it was. Now it's $75. Go figure. It's increased at that pace. Thanks very much for that, text 0467 842 722. If you want to tell me your thoughts, let's talk about the wine industry, which is experiencing one of its lowest points on record, and some businesses will find the economic challenges too much and forced to exit the industry. That's a sobering analysis from John Clarepeck, who owns below and above winery, producing small batch wines on his farm in the Pemberton region in WA's southwest. It follows the news that in Margaret River, Tate Wine, founded and owned by Franklin Tate, has collapsed, owing creditors millions of dollars, and it's now in the hands of receivers and managers FTI Consulting. John Clarepeck says every winemaker, no matter what the scale, is facing a series of strong headwinds, some known and some might be a little harder to spot.
On the demand side, and I think this gets most of the media side of it, the demand side is probably the biggest single issue. Since COVID, we've had I think it's 9% CAGR drop in volumes. The line before that was steady year-on-year growth was always coming. But the last 5 years, you've had negative growth. So I think it's 21 to now, it's negative 9%. And in an industry where you've had full supply, negative 9%, most commodities can't withstand even flat lines, let alone a negative 9%. And that has a couple of sub-elements. One of the biggest ones being the growth in the use of all things cannabis. The line of alcohol consumption and the line of cannabis consumption crossed paths last year, where cannabis is now higher daily use than alcohol. So it's not so much the headline you see is, oh, you know, the younger generation, wellness, etc. I dispute that. I think it's more of a case of drugs taking the place of alcohol for a lot of people, and that's shown up in the consumption. So you've got a negative trend, particularly in the younger groups, away from alcohol, and that includes wine. And then the other part of that is the WHO has had some particularly strong lobbying bodies in that organisation that have put alcohol in Group A carcinogens. Group A carcinogens are nicotine, asbestos, so alcohol's grouped with those items. And there's pushes to put, you know, the same warnings that are on cigarette packets go onto bottles of wine. You saw the effect of that on cigarette sales, and we could spend a whole session on why that is wrong, et cetera, and the studies that are skewed to, you know, basically what finding do you want, and you can produce a report to show it. But that has a negative impact because the media picks up on that, and the social media in particular puts all the negative messages out. That's a significant issue for everyone in the drinks business.
Well, there's a lot working against the industry then, isn't there, against the wine industry. Would you assume other businesses are in a similar situation or very close to what's going on with the Tate wine business?
Yeah, well, the whole world is in the same situation, not just Tate in Margaret River. It's the whole WA industry, the whole Australian industry, the whole worldwide industry is facing these headwinds. I have to mention that the other part of it, and particularly on the demand side, particular varietals have always come in and out of favour. So if you're in a varietal that has had disproportionate drops in demand, so 9% is the overall alcohol, but you've got varieties like Sauvignon Blanc or Shiraz, whatever, which have had bigger falls in demand, and that plays into demand. But the effect across the world is the supply side. The supply side, I've been just recently to Chile. I spent a night at the biggest vineyard owners in Chile, staying on their property, and they've got thousands of hectares of grapes, and I don't know how much they produce, but they're the biggest by volume in Chile, producing at the top end and the low end, and they're feeling the strain of the industry at the moment as well. Napa Valley was over there as well earlier on in the year. Not in Napa itself, but in the state, there's grape pools going on there. There's vine pools going on in across Australia, South Australia, Victoria, There's massive vine pools in Italy and France as well. So the supply side is basically too high as well. And added to that, you've got, you know, everyone knows about the tariff issues that anyone exporting into the US faces. That wine that would have gone there ends up going somewhere else. And every bottle of cheap Italian, Chilean or French wine that's put into this market to dispose of it at a low price, try not to buy it or consume it because it's competing against the local producer who it just can't compete against that volume that's finding its way into this market.
What are you doing at your place, in your business, to manage some of these challenges today?
We've actually come off a couple of very good years, but the imbalances, we're on one of the varieties, Sauvignon Blanc. The Sauvignon Blanc market is oversupplied. We don't yield as high as New Zealand and places like Chile, etc., where they get three times what we get per hectare and have lower labour costs, etc. So as an example, to make our Sauvignon Blanc work, we'd have to sell that product for $50 to $60. The market for $50 to $60 Sauvignon Blanc doesn't exist, or if it does, it's so small. Most people are buying the top-end stuff from France. So we've taken the move of removing the Sauvignon Blanc, except for a very small amount. 95% of it we've pulled out this year because going forward, there's no demand for that product at a price that can justify the cost of producing it. And it comes down to an economic decision. If you can't sell it for more than it costs, it's got to come out.
That's John Clairpeck, the owner of Below and Above Winery, WA Southwest, speaking there to Belinda Varaschetti with some really hard truths and some interesting theories on why it's so difficult for wine at the moment. One of those is he thinks cannabis consumption has overtaken wine consumption and literally people are replacing their drug of choice, maybe using an illegal one in the place of what has been legal and built the backbone of regional communities in a number of areas. You can tell me what you think about that, 0467 842 722. And what do you pair with wine? Let's talk about cheese right now on the Country Hour, because in the heart of Gippsland dairy country, one woman is known as the Queen of Cheddar. Now, that is a title I can get behind. Ferial Zekerman is trained as a pharmacist, but over the last three decades has made a name for herself as an award-winning cheesemaker. And Faith Tabaluyan had to go and find out more.
Ferial Zekerman is used to the hum of hoses and milk vats.
So everything here is designed to make cheddar cheese, and the English territorials like Red Leicester, Sage, Derby, Cheshire.
For three decades, Ms. Zekerman has been producing handcrafted cheese from her Mafra factory in the heart of Gippsland dairy country. But her cheesemaking journey started in her grandma's Cypriot kitchen with a batch of homemade halloumi.
Well, halloumi is a rennetted curd cheese, so it was a matter of heating the milk to body temperature, adding the rennet, separating the curds from the whey, and then pressing the curd, and then storing it in a brine bucket, a strong brine bucket, because there was no refrigeration in Cyprus when my grandmother was making it. So that preserved the cheese throughout all seasons, basically.
Is that when you first realised that cheese was something that you were really passionate about? Or
I don't think I was passionate about cheese as such, but the technology I was passionate about was very interesting. There's a huge range of cheeses and they're all different and they're all very challenging. Yeah, that's the bit I like.
In a previous life, Ms. Zekerman worked as a pharmacist, but she's now a master cheesemaker, most famous for her award-winning cheddar. Ms. Zekerman says it all starts with fresh milk from her herd of Tanamba dairy cows.
Well, I have a little transport truck, so the driver takes the milk from the farm at about 4:30 in the afternoon. He brings it back here and puts it into our refrigerated silos here, and then the next morning it's processed.
With a keen eye for detail, Ms. Zekerman soon transforms this milk into cheese.
We bring the milk in and it's pasteurised at 72 degrees for 16 seconds. And then it goes through a regen section where it's cooled down to vat temperature, 33 degrees. We add a fermenting culture, which ripens for an hour, developing acid from the lactose, lactic acid. We let the rennet set for 40 minutes and cut it into 1 centimetre cubes. So once it's cut, it's gently stirred for about 10 minutes and then the heat is applied to extract moisture from the curd. We monitor the acidity as the curd develops, and when we reach a pH of about 5.4, we mill the curd and add salt, and the salt slows the fermentation considerably. And so the parameters are 36% moisture in the cheese, a salt concentration of 2%, and an express of pH 5.4. So that preserves the cheese.
Back in the factory, Ms. Zekiman explains how acidity gives cheddar its distinct flavour.
Interestingly, with cheddar, when it first is made, the pH is about 5.4. As it matures, the pH rises because the amino acids are released, which are alkaline. So you end up with a pH of about 6 or 6.6 at about 6 months old. And that's when it develops that sweetness.
Right.
With a bit of a sharpness attached, you know, that balanced sweet sharp.
Today, Ms. Zekiman's cheeses travel all over Australia and the world.
We had an inquiry from overseas, Singapore, Malaysia, and our cheese had to be halal, and we were audited by halal auditors. So this product now goes on all the airlines, the Etihads, the Emiratis, the Qatars. So it's the halal certification that drives us, I think.
And Ms. Zekiman says her cheesemaking team is just as international.
I have several girls from Thailand, several people from Vietnam, the Philippines, and a lot of Aussies, and they're a great team. They get on well.
Seems like quite a family, actually.
It is.
And I guess you have to get used to having early mornings together.
Yep, they're all very loyal and committed.
That's Ferial Zekiman, owner and head cheesemaker at the Mafra Cheese Company, ending that story from Faith Tabaluyan. John's on the line. Just quickly before we go to rural news on the issue of the difficulties of the wine industry. John, what did you want to say?
Oh, g'day, John. Sorry, I'm John, you're Warwick. Just trying to get a cow in through the gate. About 20-odd, 25 years ago, there was a huge problem with Australian wine being exported into the UK. And there was a massive glut, and you could buy wine at about half the price in England than you could buy it here, which was, I was quite surprised about the development of international markets for Australian wine being sold as a bulk cheap product rather than a high brand. High-end.
And that changed, though, with China, right? Like, suddenly we became a premium exporter rather than a bulk exporter, but it hasn't made anything better for the industry.
I haven't followed it up too much. Hopefully one of your experts who work in statistics who monitor export sales and the price equilibrium... country of origin premium pricing for Australian goods in foreign markets is the thing that we need to do, which is the reverse of buying French wines in Australia. Hang on, mate. I've got to go. I've got to get to
Okay. Look after your cow, John. Thanks very much for your call. 1300 977 222. If you want to give us a ring here on the Country Hour, we'll take a call while you're trying to get a cow through a gate. Let's go to rural news in the meantime. Jane McNaughton has those details. Hi, Jane.
Good afternoon, Warwick. More than 1,000 emus have been culled near the Western Australian State Barrier Fence in the northeast grain growing region. Chris Patmore is the chair of the Central Wheat Belt Biosecurity Association, which used a helicopter over a day and a half to shoot the emus in four shires about 350 kilometres north of Perth. It's the first time the association has had to run an emu control program, but he says it was necessary because of the number of birds damaging crops, fences and the environment.
When it gets to the stage where there's hundreds of emus in bunches running from one farm to another, flattening fences and smashing down crops, well, one landholder on his own can't fix that problem, and that's where we've got to take more serious action. Just by aerial shooting from a helicopter with the biosecurity group, it was all done to absolute best practice. The landholders all had damage control permits from DBCA. We used licensed pest management technicians who are all trained with their firearms to do this sort of work, and a full reporting system afterwards. Yeah, we spent about $20,000 doing it, but it wasn't just a emu shoot. As I said, it was the aerial baiting for dogs on the way up and shooting emus on the way back. The two programs were done with the one job.
Grain markets are tracking higher across the board thanks to improved US-China trade relations and a delayed harvest here that has left some buyers short. That's according to Lyndon Stevens, Eastern Australian manager with Clear Grain Exchange. He says prices are firming up as Victorians start to harvest.
So for sort of an ASW wheat delivered into the Melbourne Geelong zone, we're seeing that bid at around that $340 to $350 mark, which is up probably about $10 or $15 over the last few weeks. Barley's come up off its lows of the low 300s, and this week we've seen bids into that Melbourne Geelong zone at $320. Canola has been that one commodity that's really hung in there probably over the last 12 months. And for canola delivered into Geelong, Melbourne, we're seeing that between $800 and $820. And then the GM canola, we're seeing about $80 discount. And lentils also have come up off their lows, which we were seeing. I think they even slipped into the high 500s. We've been seeing that bid this week around $620 to $630.
A new model that can predict marine heat waves has been developed between the CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology. Marine heat waves have been devastating in areas like Tasmania, where warmer oceans have affected traditional fishing grounds. Alistair Hobday from the CSIRO explains how it works.
We've now got the capacity to produce forecasts up to 3 months into the future. We've got a new ocean atmosphere model that now gives us much higher resolution look at the ocean, and that's at about 25 kilometre resolution compared to about 100 kilometres in the previous decade. With this kind of model, we can run past years and compare whether or not our model could predict whether or not a marine heat wave would emerge. So we looked, for example, in 1990, made a prediction, and then looked at if a heat wave emerged. 1991, made a prediction, looked at if it emerged, and so on. And so we know that our skill in doing this is about 70% correct at a lead time of 3 months. So in 7 out of 10 years, we will be correct that a marine heat wave emerges. The definition of a marine heat wave is 5 days or more of temperatures that are in the top 10% for a location and a time of year.
And mango season is well underway in Australia, and this year a new variety is hitting the shelves. Sophie Johnson reports.
For the first time this year, the new Ruby Gold variety has been produced to commercial volumes. John Nardi is the business manager for tropical fruits with Favco. He has been working with the Ruby Gold growers who are based in Dimbula in far north Queensland.
Typically has a really nice ruby, maroony sort of maroon sort of blush to it, so it looks fantastic. So when it's ripened, it's got that beautiful blush on a nice sort of yellow-orange background. So it really looks fantastic. And it's just got a really good, strong KP-type flavour, which is what we all love.
The Ruby Gold came about naturally on farm. And for the past decade, Mr. Nardi has helped the growers, the Palumbo family, to develop the variety.
My understanding is it was pretty much just a branch on a normal Kensington Pride tree. It's grown over the years from there. They've got more plantings in the ground.
Picking for this season's crop is underway this week, with the fruit expected to hit supermarket shelves soon after.
And that's today's Rural News Watts.
Ruby Gold Mango. Just writing that down to look out for in the shop. I love trying new things. And that sounds delicious. A freak arm of a Kensington Pride tree starting a whole new variety. You're listening to The Country Hour. Someone sent a text saying, can we find out if John got the cow in or not? I kind of want to know that too. John, if you're listening, keep us updated. In the meantime, Mark Analak can keep you updated with the weather. Senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Warwick. How are you going?
Yeah, good. How is it looking around Victoria this lunchtime?
Well, it was a very cold start to the day. In fact, some locations recorded their coldest November day on record and didn't just break it. They sort of smashed their previous records. Wangaratta got down to minus 1.3 this morning. Previous November record was 0.1 degrees, so almost 1.5 degrees cooler than the record. Yarrawonga's another one that sort of broke a record. Benalla. So pretty much right across that sort of northern country and the northeast plains, northeast district sort of area had some very cold temperatures. Even Swan Hill had a very, very cold 1.6 degrees this morning. We haven't seen temperatures that low since about September. So quite a cool start.
Can't imagine that's good for crops in some of those areas too. If anybody knows, or if you have something to report, flick us a text 0467 842 722. So cold start, warm day then, Mark?
Yes, and with these clear skies across the north, we're expecting the temperatures to jump up fairly quickly, and we're already seeing temperatures climbing up into the 20s across the north. Further south, there's still a sort of a broad westerly flow under the influence of a high-pressure ridge to our north. And as a result, we're seeing sort of stratocumulus cloud hovering over sort of the southwestern central districts and even into sort of western Gippsland as well, West Gippsland as well. So cloudy conditions for most of the southern parts of the state, but once you get north of the divide, clear sunny skies for the rest of today. And then as we move into sort of tomorrow, we're sort of in between a couple of systems. A cold front will move over Tasmania, and the tail end of that cold front will brush over the sort of the southern coastal fringes of the state. So we may see some cloud building up across the south and maybe a spot or two of shower activity. Don't expect too much. And then over South Australia, there's a low pressure system forming. So there'll be some high cloud drifting in from the west. Again, maybe a spot or two moving into the far west of the state later tomorrow. But all in all, most places should be fine under sort of a ridge extending across the state. Rainfall totals will be, you know, less than a couple of millimetres at most, I would have thought. Moving into Friday, we're still sort of wedged between those two systems, although that low pressure system is getting very close to us by the end of Friday. It looks like we'll start to see some weather moving into the far west of the state on Friday, with showers and thunderstorms extending over western districts later Friday. And then those showers and thunderstorms will continue to move through central parts of the state in the early hours of Saturday morning across to eastern districts by sort of lunchtime. And then as that low pressure system drifts off into the Tasman Saturday night, the weather will start to clear as well. Following in behind that cold front is a broad westerly airstream. A series of cold fronts will follow in behind in that westerly flow. So we're probably likely to see periods of increased shower activity across southern parts of the state and maybe some isolated showers pushing into the north of the state through Sunday and into the early part of next week. And just quickly looking ahead to the middle part of next week, we maintain some form of southwesterly flow on the eastern flank of an approaching high-pressure system. So one would expect showers and cloud to persist about southern parts of the state, but mostly fine conditions for northern parts or north of the divide through the early part or early to mid part of next week, Warwick.
And so warnings-wise for tomorrow, what are we looking at there, Mark?
We don't really have anything tomorrow. At this stage, we're fairly stable.
I know it's not exactly you, but I think some fire danger is going to start to get up, particularly in the northwest of the state. Is that right?
Yeah, we've had a bit of a change there in terms of it's a combination of dry fuel load and slightly warmer temperatures, northerly winds freshening a little bit. So we are likely to see perhaps extreme fire danger for the Mallee. At this stage, with probably some high fire danger for some other districts, but at this stage, it's a possibility of extreme fire danger for the Mallee district tomorrow.
So keep an eye on that. Obviously, ABC Radio, if further forecasts are made this afternoon and authorities release information, we'll bring that to you. Prue Bentley's Drive program on air between 3 and 6 tonight for you. And, of course, ABC Evenings talk about this stuff too. So on ABC Local Radio, we'll be able to look after that. Mark Analak, anything else I need to know?
Not unless you've got any text messages coming in asking questions.
Mate, no. ACDC weather for Sunday night at the MCG is the only text I have for you. And I'm actually going to that, so I think I've got a personal interest in this texter.
Yeah, I think you might want to take a jacket with you. It's it'd be cooler conditions, and there'd be a good chance of a shower coming through, I would think. So I would be rugging up with a jacket.
I will not be under a stadium roof. I'll be on the turf of the MCG, so no luck for me. But I think I'll still have a good time, Mark. Hey, Mark, thanks very much for the update.
No worries. Cheers.
Mark Analak, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau. I'm about to head to Annie Brown, who's out and about at a really interesting-looking conference today. Before we get there, I know you have been listening to the last couple of days to the Country Hour, and we've been speaking a lot about US butter, which has inadvertently been found on Australian shelves as one of the home brand label products for Woolworths, one of the biggest supermarkets, or the biggest supermarket chain in Australia. In green and gold packaging, the dairy industry has not been happy about that, as you've heard. There's a story online if you want to read a lot more about that, abc.net.au/rural if you want to read more. Just had some extra information come through from Craig, who's a known as Dairyman NZ on Twitter, very high profile dairy farmer, just about the cost metrics around US butter compared to the rest of the world right now. This is what he says. US butter's trading at $2,000 per metric ton cheaper on GDT, global dairy trade, than butter from Oceania and Europe. It's cheaper because it's a lower, because it's lower fat content and is grain fed, and it's not in high demand. Also, it's no good for baking recipes outside of North America due to high water content. So that's information coming from a dairy farmer across the ditch, so to speak, just on why maybe US butter is finding its way around the world that you might find interesting. Let's continue our little journey, not around the world, but around the state. Well, actually, even maybe beyond the state. Let's go to the Victorian Bioenergy Forum. No, it's outside of the border, in Wodonga, run by the Victorian Bioenergy Network. Annie Brown, our reporter, is there. Good afternoon, Annie. How's it all going? What can you tell us?
Good afternoon, Warwick. Yeah, we've just broken up for lunchtime here at the Cube in Wodonga for the Albury-Wodonga Bioenergy Forum. We've been in a lot of discussions this morning talking about all the different kinds of bioenergy. So bioenergy obviously being renewable energy that we create from things like cropping, organic matters, lots of different things. And agriculture comes up a lot in these conversations at the moment. But to tell us a bit more, someone who knows a lot more about bioenergy than I do, I'm joined by the Executive Officer, Ragini Prasad, from the Victorian Bioenergy Network. Welcome to the country, Al.
Thank you, Annie. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here in Wodonga. And also interesting, I thought, when some of the early conversations at the forum today is all the examples of bioenergy used around here in Wodonga.
Yeah. Yeah, look, it's a really versatile form of energy. And like I said, with the circular economy, what we're trying to do is capitalise on the organic matter. So you've got a lot of food processing around here and a lot of organic waste gets generated as a result. And that can go to landfill where it generates methane, or it can get used and converted into different forms of energy. And with a lot of the renewables that we're talking about, solar and wind, they're intermittent, which means that you get energy when the sun shines, when the wind's blowing, whereas with bioenergy, you can store it. It's effectively like a battery, so it's dispatchable, and so it can offload those peaks that you get with other forms of renewables. So it's really complementary, and it sits really well with a regional story because you've got a lot of activity here. You've got a lot of food manufacturing, a lot of agriculture, a lot of industry. So we want to capitalise on that, and then you generate significant amounts of long-term green jobs as a result. So we're trying to help people here through this event understand what's possible, and there's already bits and pieces that are happening as you got a glimpse into. So what we want to do is expand that.
Yeah, so our Northeast Water Network here in the northeast of the state, they're 100% renewable, they were saying, and they're building a biogas plant at the moment in West Wodonga. Pretty impressive. They also said they're looking for opportunities to find this organic matter, or manure, really, to bring into their plant as well. And they use a lot of the waste from Mars, the pet care factory that we have here in Wodonga, and Wodonga Rendering. So agriculture just ties in so well to this.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, it's a beautiful story. I mean, they're a hub, they're already processing waste, so they've got trade waste that's coming into site. And now, because they've built the facility there, there's so much more opportunity for waste, from dairies, from other sorts of manufacturers that would get taken off-site, taken elsewhere. How can we use that to generate energy here? And what they're looking to do is really inspiring. And it's when willing companies come together to try and innovate, there's real opportunities there. So we're really excited about that through the Bioenergy Forum, and we want to share those stories and get people to understand that we can actually do renewable energy from waste resources generated here in Australia.
Obviously, you're here to promote bioenergy. How much is bioenergy used currently in Australia? Like, where are we?
Look, in its traditional sense, bioenergy is wood. So if you've got a wood fire at home, that's bioenergy. But modern bioenergy is still very small. In the likes of Denmark, Sweden, UK, it's significantly more. So they're well advanced. So for the last 20, 30 years, they've been going down this pathway. We haven't yet in Australia. We've only just started. We've had the first biomethane gas injected into the grid project in Malabar in Sydney. We're hoping to expand that significantly more because we've got the waste feedstock, we've got the technology. It's a here and now technology, so we want to leverage that. In terms of how much it can produce, certainly the initial data is saying it can offset the gas in the network, so you can replace natural gas with renewable gas, which is basically utilising the waste feedstocks here in Australia to generate renewable gas, which is just a win-win.
What's the biggest barrier for bioenergy sort of becoming more prominent in Australia?
Look, it's really awareness and it's policy. So that's what we're trying to do through the network, is to raise awareness, to understand that the technology is here, to build confidence in the technology, to get the right policy environment, to also create a level playing field. All technologies get some form of subsidy. So certainly to get the sector up and going, we need some initial intervention. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to educate, we're trying to inform, we're trying to dispel some of the myths that are out there, and for people to recognise, hey, we can do this here and now, and we've got significant amounts of waste that is just, you know, either crops are being burnt on the field, waste stubble, or, you know, organic matter going to landfill. So we want to capitalise on that.
Turning waste into power. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. What's the one thing you hope people can take away from the forum or in general about bioenergy?
Look, it's confidence that there are other options there apart from wind and solar that we need to be looking at that are truly circular. So I would love people to actually, you know, go into Google, type, find out what bioenergy is all about, and recognise that we can do it here and now, because it's we build this bottom up. You know, where sometimes we wait for things to be top down, but the more people who become aware of this and to see that it's actually happening here, that we can start advocating for change.
That was one of the biggest takeaways for me, was just realising how much it's already happening. You know, we've got the JBS Rivoli Piggery just down the road in Corowa. They have a massive biogas system that they basically run their whole farm off.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're going for a site visit there tomorrow so that people get a hands-on experience of what they're doing. So absolutely, it's here and now. And I just want, one of the things is Rivoli, JBS, Northeast Water at the moment, they're what's called behind the meter. So they're using it on site. But we're hoping with the significant amounts of feedstock, there's an opportunity to generate more energy that then can get fed into the grid, whether it's a gas grid, electricity grid.
There you go. Agriculture powering.
Yes, the regions.
Ragnar, thank you so much. I'll let you go grab some lunch because we've only got a short break before you head back in there. But thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks so much, Annie.
There you go, Warwick. It's been fascinating. We've got so many different companies here telling us about what they're doing, from, the piggeries, who apparently have been a real leader in this industry for a long time. Also, cropping sectors as well are looking at different ways.
Annie, just on that, the interest and the names like JBS, the biggest meat processor in Australia, by far, I think it has 15,000 employees. Is there a lot of interest when companies like that are talking?
100%. And I think that Rivoli Piggery, based out in Corowa, that's one of the biggest piggeries in the southern hemisphere. I might need to check that if that's still correct. But it's a massive operation and it basically runs itself off the effluent and waste from farming pigs, which is kind of incredible.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you very much for bringing that to us. I better let you go get some lunch too. Thanks very much, Annie.
Thank you.
Annie Brown there, our reporter at the Victorian Bioenergy Forum up at Wodonga today with some big hitters. Big parts of agriculture talking about what they're doing too. Markets are on the way.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Hello, my name's Rob Armstrong. I'm a farmer just south of Ararat. I think I've been listening to The Country Hour as I just turned 60, probably 60 years ago it started, because it was always on the radio, on top of the fridge, every day.
and you still get something from it now?
All the time. I would never miss it. I always want to hear the market reports. I want to know what's going around me all the time. So I'm always listening to the ABC Country Hour. It's the best show.
And it's our birthday, our 80th birthday this year. You got a message for us?
Yeah, well done. And don't stop. And we need another 80 years of this. Don't stop whatever you do. They're really important.
80 years of the Country Hour.
And I have a text on the line here saying, great idea for Northern Victoria would be a bioenergy plant, especially with a big hay industry. It'd be great for the area, yet you just need the price to be right. Thanks very much for your text. Speaking of prices being right. Let's head off to markets today. Got a couple of sheep and lambs and a cattle market to get through. We'll go to Hamilton to kick things off. Chris Agnew has those details there. Take it away, Chris.
Thanks, Warwick. At Hamilton Agents Yard, 11,900 sheep and lambs, an increase of 5,630 compared to last week's offering. The main increase being new season's lambs, indicating the start for the selling season at the Hamilton area. New season's lambs to the trade remained firm to slightly dearer, for more so for the heavier weights over 26 kilos, and they were averaging between 1,050 and 1,200 cents a kilogram carcass weight, with the best lamb topping at $419 per head. It was a very good feeder and restocker competition on the lighter weight new season's lambs, the 12 to 16 kilo lambs making from 131 to 210, while the 18 to 22 is 210 to 276, and the 22 to 26 kilo range selling from $256 to $320 per head. It was a good quality yarding of sheep with a good mixture of crossbreds and merinos. The market was slightly softer for heavyweight sheep, backed by $10 to $20. However, the medium and light sheep were slightly dearer. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. We'll continue along the lines and go to your partner in crime, Graeme Pymer, who's over at Horsham Sheep and Lambs. Good afternoon, Graeme.
Good afternoon, everyone. Small increase in lamb numbers to 7,550 and 2,000 sheep were yarded. Lead pens of lamb showed good weight and finish. Regular buying group operated in another strong market. Lambs generally selling $5 to $10 head up on last week. Medium and heavy trade weight sold from $250 to $299. Heavy weight sold from $365 to $396. Dorper lamb sold from $210 to $293. Feeders and restockers were active and paid from $195 to $244. Lighter weights from $112 to $196. And from $102 to $162 for merino lambs. The sheep covered all weights and grades and sold to the regular buying group at strong levels. Heavy sheep $5 to $10 head dear and more in places. Merino weathers to $230, merino ewes to $242, crossbred ewes to $292. The light trade lamb sold from $200 to $255, averaging $1,100. Medium trade weight sold from $250 to $281, average $1,140. And Graeme Pymer at Horsham from LA.
Thank you very much, Graeme. Lucky last is Bairnsdale Cattle. Brendan Fletch is there. G'day, Fletch.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers increased to 560. That's 370 more, with the regular buyers operating in a cheaper market in places. Quality declined in the prime cattle, while cows represented most of the sale. Trade cattle lost a few cents in line with quality. Ground cattle eased slightly on softer competition. Cows gave back 10 to 20 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 754 to 820 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls sold firm. Yearling steers to restockers sold from 450 to 470, with a handful to the trade up to 500 cents. Yearling heifers to the trade 440 to 480. Ground steers and bullocks 440 to 480. Manufacturing steers 386 to 464. Heavy ground heifers with finish 430 to 458. Most light and medium weight cows 280 to 410. Heavyweights 362 to 430. Restocking cows 368 to 440. Heavy bulls 388 to 450. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. Well, we started the Country Hour today by talking about a new report of the exotic pest tomato potato psyllid, which has been found in the northern suburbs of Melbourne in a garden. Now, it's not our first detection of this. About a year ago, exactly a year ago, actually, on November 12 last year, it was found on the Bellarine Peninsula. There are still biosecurity restrictions in place due to that detection. Now, a new detection has been found. Victoria Victoria. In Victoria, there'll be briefing for industry and the nursery industry as well on what this will mean for them and what control orders will be in place. Victoria's Chief Plant Health Officer, Dr. Rosa Cernoff, will join you on the program tomorrow. In fact, she'll be speaking to us this afternoon. So you'll probably hear her on Rural Reports in the morning and then the Country Hour at midday. So if that's something that concerns you and you want to know more about tomato, potato, psyllid, or how Victoria is dealing with these seed potatoes that are found to have mop top virus that haven't been planted, but no one has decided what to do with them yet, we will ask her about that for you on her on your behalf, and we'll have that on the program tomorrow. So tune in then or listen back to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. Victorian Country Hour is all you search for, and I'll catch you tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.